That jangly opening chord in The Beatles' A Hard Day's Night is certainly one of the most recognizable in pop music. Sort of sounds like a guitarist telling his bandmates, "Hey, we're doing a song here, so listen up." But a math professor in Canada looked into just how the Beatles produced that sound back in 1964, before there were synthesizers and studio electronics like they have today. So to take us through this Beatles mathematical mystery tour, we've called on our math guy, Keith Devlin. He joins us from the studios of Stanford University. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Scott. Good to speak to you again.
And nice to talk to you. Look, we know that music has math, but other than the tempo and number of verses, where's the math?
Sounds themselves are very mathematical things. And that was the secret to unravelling this particular mystery of this sound. And as you said, it's obviously guitar-like, but if you listen closely, it's not like any guitar that anyone's really ever heard played live. And so...
Well, now, let's credit the mathematician who got involved in this investigation, Jason Brown at Dalhousie University.
Mm-hmm. And what Brown did was he took some mathematics that's fundamental to modern musical theory and to modern musical technology, in fact. That was mathematics invented at the late 18th, early 19th century by a French mathematician called Joseph Fourier. And Fourier showed how you can analyse any kind of waves. In fact, Fourier was studying heat dissipation waves, but let's continue to talk in terms of sound waves. Sound waves come in different kinds. The simplest kind is the kind of sound you'll get when you sound a pure note, for example, with a tuning fork. Mm-hmm. And that's a beautifully symmetrical, simple wave that we call a sine wave. That's sine spelled S-I-N-E. A sine wave, beautiful hills and valleys that go on and on smoothly. At the other end of the spectrum, as it were, you've got the kind of sound wave caused by conversation or a typical musical instrument. What Fourier showed, and it's an incredibly remarkable result, take a sound wave, no matter how complicated, you can decompose it into individual sine waves, these simple sine waves, that are superimposed to give that. What Jason Brown did, it's known as Fourier analysis, he took the recording of this Beatles opening chord from A Hard Day's Night. On a computer, he didn't have to write the software, you can now get the software off the shelf, was able to analyse that sound wave, and this took him a long time, and it turns out that even he first of all thought, well, you know, George Harrison had a 12-string guitar, maybe it's that. No, you can't produce that same spectrum of sine waves with a 12-string guitar. Maybe the other Beatles came in with their guitars. No, that doesn't work either. Eventually, he figured out that what must have been happening was George Martin, the producer, at the same time, hit the piano keyboard. So that opening chord isn't a pure guitar. There's a piano on there as well. And it was that mixture of guitars and piano that gives it that rather unique sound.
Keith, I salute the scholarship involved, but wouldn't it have been possible to get this, you know, settled in just 2 minutes by asking Sir Paul McCartney, how did you guys do it?
You know, you'd think that, but in fact, interestingly enough, the thing that Jason Brown, this mathematician, is now trying is there is actually some dispute between... Well, it was a historical dispute between Lennon and McCartney. Lennon, of course, can no longer contribute to that. But there's a famous song that was recorded a year after Hard Day's Night on the Rubber Soul album called In My Life.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed.
And ever since that was recorded, there's been this dispute as to who wrote that. John Lennon claimed that he wrote the whole thing except for a musical bridge that McCartney eventually wrote. McCartney has always claimed, no, he actually wrote the music for that as well. Jason Brown, he's now analysing this particular song and all of the other Beatles' music in order to see if he can figure it out. In other words, what he was trying to do is, by analysing lots of Beatles songs, he wants to see if he can find a sort of an audio fingerprint, a sound print, if you like, of songs that were written by Lennon and songs that were written by McCartney. If you can find some mathematical pattern in the waveforms that distinguishes their two composing styles, then he'll be able to look at that and see which pattern In My Life fits.
Weekend Edition's math guy, Keith Devlin, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Scott, and season's greetings to you.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog.
You're listening to the Fab Four from Weekend Edition, NPR News. There can't be a composer whose name has been more often characterized as quintessentially American than Aaron Copland.
Thank you.
That's from Copland's ballet Rodeo. But the list goes on. Fanfare for the Common Man, Appalachian Spring, Billy the Kid. Maren Alsop, music director of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, has just released a CD of Aaron Copland's music on Naxos. And in April, she will conduct Copland Symphony No. 3 with the BSO. Maren Alsop is back with us in our studios. Thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be here, Scott. Thanks.
So how does the kid from Brooklyn, the son of Russian Jewish immigrants, become considered the, I'll use the phrase again, you can't avoid it, the quintessentially American composer?
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I picture, you know, this kid in the apartment in Brooklyn thinking, I wonder what America's really like.
Yeah.
And, you know, somehow he's able to conjure up this image of big sky, openness, you know, the majesty of landscape. And he does it through very defined compositional techniques. I'm thinking Fanfare for the Common Man. He uses big open intervals, and they're called actually perfect intervals, perfect fourths, perfect fifths, and they're intervals that are quite empty. And I don't mean that in an emotional sense, but they have a lot of space.
Where does Copland fit into the great music figures of the 20th century or perhaps of all time?
I think he's right up there. The thing that I really want to point out for people, though, is that the Copland we're talking about, you know, the sort of quintessential American sound, is not the full Copland.
Yeah.
You know, Copland was an incredibly diverse composer. He wrote serial music, 12-tone, atonal music, which is also spectacular. He wrote music that was very angular and dissonant. He wrote songs. He wrote music for film. He wrote music for all kinds of occasion. You know, he wrote the first opera conceived for television. So this was a guy who was extraordinarily versatile. And I think we think of him, even though it's a wonderful view of him, I think it's somewhat one-dimensional.
You're conducting the Third Symphony in the spring.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite pieces of all time. And, you know, it's one of my party pieces. It's so American, you know, as Copland is, but at the same time, it's extremely sophisticated piece. And what happened was when he got the commission to write this Third Symphony, he went back a couple of years to his Fanfare for the Common Man, which he had written for Cincinnati Symphony, and he takes this 3-minute fanfare and he manages to dissect it and turn it upside down and inside out, and by really sort of looking at it under a microscope and taking it apart, he's able to use that small amount of material to create a 40-minute symphony, which is spectacular. And the fanfare finally comes in, sort of the payoff of the whole piece, at the last movement. I'm not sure everyone could accurately say that's the fanfare for the Common Man, but, you know, people respond to it, oh, it's from the Olympics, or, yeah, you know, they have this sort of
visceral response. They play it before the Luge Championships or something.
Now.
Well, but I wonder if, because we hear it so much, do we sometimes miss appreciating its, how remarkable
well,
a piece of music it is?
You know, I think you're right in that way, and that's what's so incredible about this Third Symphony. It's the unexpected appearance of the fanfare, and yet the whole first three movements have been preparing us for it. You know, that's another important aspect of Copland, his simplicity, his devotion to simplicity, but not not simple-minded. You know, it's very very sophisticated simplicity. At the beginning of this symphony, he takes that opening interval of the fanfare and he turns it upside down and he gives it to the violins quietly. So it's virtually unrecognizable. But this starts setting the stage so that even if you're not a trained musician, there's sort of this organic acceptance of all the material during the first 30 minutes of the piece.
Ask you about these other symphonies, because I gather you've recorded these with the Bournemouth Symphony, your other job,
yes,
on Naxos. And why are they not nearly as well known as the Third?
Well, I think the element of the having the fanfare for the common man is very, very appealing about the Third Symphony. Also, the Third Symphony is a major full-scale work. You know, it was compared at the time to the works of Mahler, even. Mm-hmm. The other three symphonies that I recently recorded are symphonies that didn't necessarily start as symphonies. One of them, which is called the Short Symphony, started as a ballet score to a vampire story. One of the symphonies is called the Dance Symphony, so that doesn't really lend itself to the same kind of gravitas. And his first symphony was originally written for an organ soloist with symphony orchestra, and then he reorchestrated it. So they all have sort of these hybrid histories, and I think that doesn't help with their popularity. Do you know what I mean? People are confused about what they are.
But to hear them now, can you hear him experimenting?
Oh, absolutely. That's the most fantastic thing. It's almost like reading a biography in a way, just listening to these early symphonies. You hear, there's also another element about Copland. It's this very playful quality. You know, it's kind of a gleam in his eye and just a little wink and a nod. You hear him combining instruments like the bassoon and the woodblock and collegno in the strings, meaning you play with the wood. So there's a playful quality about it. And also in the slow music, there's a yearning that I think later becomes part of the American sound and the American spirit that he conveys. You know, this pioneer, you just can see someone out on the plains after a long journey, you know, yearning for home. There's something about it that feels, as an American, feels American to me.
Curious, when you perform Copland, let's say in Bournemouth, does the audience there walk out saying, he's so quintessentially American? Or is that something we've fallen into?
You know, it's interesting because I've found that in Europe and especially in the UK, people really, they relate to, I think, the music, particularly as a representation of the ideal of what America is about. It's not just about the landscape. There's another kind of quality to the music. There's a quality of possibility and immediacy. Sort of what you see is what you get. And I think this idea of possibility is perhaps even more quintessentially American than the idea of the big sky landscape.
Maestro, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
Maren Alsop, musical director of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. And to hear more Aaron Copland, for that matter, to hear more of Maren Alsop, go to our website, npr.org/music. This is Weekend Edition. Hope you're having happy holidays. I'm Scott Simon.
In the 1960s, Eartha Kitt famously caused a controversy when she denounced the Vietnam War at a White House luncheon. Still, it's fitting that Miss Kitt passed away yesterday on a holiday she has forever given a sultry swing.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl.
Eartha Kitt was 81 and still known as a sensual beauty with a purring voice when she died. I spoke with her this time last year, and she told me this song gave her reason to reflect on her own life's wish list.
Because every time I sing Santa Baby, I laugh more at myself when I'm singing that song because I know what I've gone through. And the song says, Santa Baby, slip a sable under the tree. But all the men who have done that with me and never stayed with me. So I realize everything that I want in life, I have to pay for myself. And I really love that because then nobody owns me but me.
Eartha Kitt had to work for everything she got. She was born in 1927 on a cotton plantation in South Carolina, the unwanted child of a white father she never knew and a black mother.
My first scene in life was us walking down a road trying to find some place to stay because every time she knocked on a door to ask if she could stay there, I would always hear a great big voice that said, no, I don't want that yellow gal in my house when they saw what color I am.
Growing up as a mixed-race child in the South was so difficult, Eartha Kitt's mother sent her to New York to live with an aunt. There she auditioned for Katherine Dunham, the pioneering African-American dancer, and toured Europe with the dance troupe. Eartha Kitt became famous on stage and in films, singing songs like I Wanna Be Evil.
But I'm tired of being pure and a nut chase. Like something that shakes its levers. I wanna go to the devil, I wanna be evil. I wanna spit tax, I wanna be evil. And cheat at jacks.
Miss Kitt was perhaps best known to fans for one role she played on the TV series Batman.
Hello, Pierre. This is Catwoman. C-A-T-W-O-M-A-N.
Always, Eartha Kitt had a passion for cabaret. She was performing in this intimate venue just 2 months ago. As she told us last year, she ended all of her cabaret shows the same way, with the same words.
I think it says it all, and I think my audience understands. Here's to life, here's to love, and here's to you.
Eartha Kitt, who passed away yesterday, here's to you.
It's a morning edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. In Bolivia, there's a movement brewing, but it has nothing to do with political turmoil that's plagued the South American country in the past. Instead, it's about music, classical music played by a little-known but up-and-coming orchestra. It's spreading the sounds of Bach and Beethoven across the capital and even into some of Bolivia's most forgotten places. NPR's Juan Ferrero reports from La Paz, Bolivia.
The concert hall is sparkling new wood floors, row upon row of soft new seating, new lighting, even a new heating system. And David Handel's orchestra is rehearsing the works of one of his favorite composers, Brahms. Welcome to Bolivia's National Symphony Orchestra, high in the Bolivian Andes. Its musicians were once a struggling ragtag group of artists who moonlighted in local clubs. And when they played classical, it was in local gymnasiums, or worse. Now the orchestra has its own concert hall, a concert hall that was once part vaudeville theater, part porn cinema. It's still being renovated, but now the work is just months away from completion, thanks to $3 million in donations. Handel is an American born in Buffalo, New York, and he's been conductor for a decade. He provides visitors with a personalized tour of the new performance space.
And as you can see, we've completely torn down a part of the building, or the old building, a 19th century building, and rebuilding it part by part to reflect the needs of the orchestra. And of course, I'm out of oxygen because we're at 12,000 feet.
To an American symphony, having its own concert hall may not sound like such a big deal. But just a few years ago, the orchestra here scrounged to pay its musicians a few bucks per performance. And it held, on good years, no more than 10 concerts, attended by 2,000 people, tops. José Hurtado plays the viola and has been with the orchestra about 15 years.
We can show that the orchestra exists. Before, we used to play 4, 5, 6 times a year, and the people here in La Paz, maybe they didn't know that the orchestra was playing. Now I can say the orchestra is much better than 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
The orchestra was founded at the end of World War II, its founding members Jews from Austria and Poland. Their philosophy was that classical music speaks to everyone, even here in the center of South America, far from European high culture. Then came hard times. Interest waned, and the orchestra found itself in crisis. David Handel came as a guest conductor, then was asked to take over. It was an unconventional path for a violinist who trained with the great German conductor, Kurt Mazur. But Handel said it offered a unique opportunity to build an orchestra from scratch and to experiment. The first thing he did was go back to basics, under the theory that everyone loves the classics. No matter that this is a country where the majority of people come from indigenous communities that have not received wide exposure to European masterworks.
It's the National Symphony. It really ought to represent everyone in the country, and it's a country that demographically is very diverse. So one of our first initiatives was to take the orchestra to El Alto.
El Alto is poor. It is also vast, with almost 800,000 people, and most of its residents are Aymara Indians. But they, and similar communities around Bolivia, have packed concerts and love the music, whether it's Tchaikovsky, Strauss, or an arrangement that includes Bolivian composers. Juan Ortega is the president of the Orchestra Foundation, which raises money and organizes concerts. He's watched as the number of people attending has increased 12-fold in a decade. But he says more needs to be done to make the orchestra more accessible to audiences and more professional at the same time. It means raising more money.
We have to make more affordable, more sustainable all this plan, to make more presentation in such a way that we get more money, which have to go to the musicians.
That's because even now, many of the musicians in the orchestra have to teach or play on the side to make ends meet. Still, the musicians say they're working harder than ever, driven by Handel's demanding rehearsals and inspired by the orchestra's newfound promise. Juan Ferrero, NPR News, La Paz.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Bobby Lee Nelson has been a mainstay of country music for 35 years. In fact, some musicians say she's the best player in her brother's band. Her brother is Willie Nelson. Yet Sister Bobby, as she's known, has never sought the spotlight. It wasn't until this year, just shy of her 77th birthday, that she made a record of her own, and she didn't even plan it. It's called Autobiography, and it's not what you might expect. Lara Pellegrinelli reports.
He only leaves his tour bus when he has to, about 2 minutes before he's due on stage.
Sign my guitar!
A few dozen fans have been on a stakeout by the loading dock at the Mayo Center in Morristown, New Jersey. They're waiting for an autograph or just a glimpse of the redheaded stranger.
Let me sign that guitar.
Beautiful, Willie, beautiful.
Behind the security detail with its walkie-talkies, a woman had already slipped by, unnoticed, her face obscured by a black cowboy hat about a gallon too large for her petite frame.
I'm nearly ready.
Even when it's her turn for a solo, the hat's all that's visible above the piano's open lid.
This is our little sister Bobby's playing the piano for y'all. She'd like to play Down Yonder.
Bobby Lee Nelson has been on the road with younger brother Willie since the early 1970s, yet she shares little of his fame. Holly George Warren is the author of Public Cowboy No. 1, The Life and Times of Gene Autry. She says Willie Nelson wouldn't be the icon he is today without his sister's crucial support.
They've had such a history playing together that the fact that she's open-minded, she'll be improvisational, and that's the key to Willie Nelson, is his improvisational guitar playing and phrasing as a singer. And Bobby lived the music with Willie out on the road, in the roadhouses, you know, back home when they were kids. And that's something you can't read off charts, you can't learn, you can't, it's got to be in you.
The Nelsons grew up in the tiny town of Abbott, Texas, raised by gospel-loving grandparents who studied music via mail-order courses. Bobby learned to play by reading the four-part harmony in hymn books, but she also discovered Boogie Woogie.
My grandmother said, "I don't know why you want to play that old stuff." But she started enjoying it, I think, herself, because she was a fun-loving woman, too. And all the kids at school loved the boogies.
Sister Bobby had her first taste of honky-tonks at 16 with her soon-to-be husband, Bud Fletcher. The charismatic Army veteran built a band around the Nelson siblings, recruiting their father to play rhythm guitar and one of their school teachers to play trombone. Fletcher modeled the music on the Western swing of Bob Wills with a twist, says Holly George Warren.
Bobby is pretty rare in that she was able to go out on the road for all those years, being the only woman in the band playing an instrument. I mean, I think most of the cases of women out on the road, they were the front person or the singing partner or the harmonizer, something like that.
Working with family members almost made it all right for women to do something as scandalous as perform in bars. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough to protect Bobby's reputation as the mother of three young boys. Fletcher became an alcoholic, and his parents took custody of their children.
I thought, how can I earn enough money to support my children and to show the world that I can support my children? I want my babies. And that was the hardest part of my life. And I couldn't play with Willie at that time because I wasn't supposed to even enter into a club. They would not have agreed to let me have my children back.
The answer was business college. Sister Bobby landed a job with the Hammond Organ Company, working in its Fort Worth offices and demonstrating instruments. Meanwhile, Brother Willie established himself as a songwriter, scoring hits for Ray Price and Patsy Cline. When he finally broke free of the Nashville system that told him what to record and who to play with, he called Bobby to New York to make his album The Troublemaker in 1973.
And sweet we shall meet on that beautiful shore.
It was a turning point for both of them.
I had never been on an airplane in my life. I'd never been any farther than driving to Nashville to see Willie. And then he said, "Gee, I've missed playing with you, Sister Bobby." And I said, "I certainly miss playing with you." Everything else didn't seem to matter at that time. My boys are all grown, fabulous young men, and if Willie wants me to go play some honky-tonks, I can certainly do it.
Down at the corner beer joint, dancing to the rock and roll. My sister likes to do it, Lord, sister likes to move her soul.
Bobby's been playing with Willie Nelson and family ever since. Harmonica player Mickey Raphael jokes that her hands are a blur on the keyboard.
We photographed her with the strobe and just slowed it down so we can really watch what they're playing. Not once during the song did her fingers ever leave her hand.
No, never once did they leave her
hand. Bassist Bee Spear says she's the foundation of the group.
She's amazing, probably the best player in the band.
Yet it wasn't until her son Freddie and brother Willie played a little trick that her solo debut came to be. They asked her to warm up the piano in their Austin recording studio while they went golfing. They secretly rolled tape. With her album now in stores, Bobby's back on the road with a bunch of wise guys.
Whenever I came to work with the band, they had made a rule that no girls, don't bring the girls on the buses. So somebody said, well, Bobby, and he said, oh, she's not a girl, she's a piano player. Which was sort of the truth at that time because I was a piano player and that came before everything else. And I guess I've put it before a lot of other things in my life. In my later years, I really have.
Everything else but family. For NPR News, I'm Lara Pellegrinelli.
To hear songs from Bobby Lee Nelson's solo record, visit nprmusic.org. Our program is directed by Greg Dixon, edited by Graham Smith, and produced by Neil Carruth. The technical director is Daniel Shukin, assisted by Sean Phillips and Peter Alina. The staff includes Melissa Gray, Art Silverman, Bilal Qureshi, Gabe O'Connor, Jocelyn Frank, Dualise Kowtow, Travis Larchuk, and Carol Klinger. Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. I'm Robert Siegel. Merry Christmas, also Happy Hanukkah. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.